Blog Talk Radio.
Debbie Guy-Geesh of Revenue Marketer Radio, and welcome to the show, everybody. You know, every Thursday we get together and we talk to revenue marketers. And today's topic is going to be the pragmatic revenue marketer. I cannot wait to hear more about this. So as you guys know, this radio show explores all facets of revenue marketing. We take a look at metrics, people and skills and compensation, organizational structure, sales and marketing alignment, and really all the key features of what it takes to be a successful revenue marketer. So today's guest I'm extremely excited to have. It is Laura Hoffman of Microscan. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Laura before we get into the interview with her. First of all, Laura's a professional marketer for 19 years, and she has a very interesting combination of experience because she's worked with both consumer and also B2B. So she's been responsible for a variety of marketing, business development, and partner sales roles. Again, a really interesting combination for a revenue marketer. And she's pioneered, championed, and implemented corporate CRM systems as well as marketing automation platforms. I'm kind of reading you the highlights of what goes into the perfect revenue marketer. And she has experience in three different marketing automation platforms. And she's a big believer in that you can utilize technology to solve business issues and also work smarter. The other thing about Laura is that she really takes a Kaizen approach of incremental change. And I have never thought about this, but this is outstanding. Kaizen means 100% change can be accomplished by a 1% change repeated 100 times. And that is a great piece of advice to any revenue marketers. She's a practicing believer in pragmatic marketing principles, which successfully combines and applies with technology and revenue marketing principles. So, Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Debbie. Thanks for having me here today, and thanks for the great intro.
Well, you are so welcome. And it is such a pleasure to have you because, you know, again, when I take a look at the perfect makeup and the perfect set of characteristics that is a revenue marketer and the results, I mean, clearly you're at the top of the list there. So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about Microscan and a little bit more about specifically what your role there is.
Sure. So at Microscan, I'm the Director of Global Marketing, and Microscan is a technology company. We focus on B2B technology sales. Our playground is factory automation, manufacturing environments for largely quality inspection points and productivity enhancements through barcode and machine vision products and solutions. So Microscan actually is a manufacturer. We design, manufacture hardware and software, and we go to market through a distribution channel that's global. So we don't sell direct. We instead sell through a global distribution channel of well over 300 systems integrators and distributors. And what they do is they package and resell our products with others for complete automation solutions. So this means that we have one central marketing department, but going to market through our channel basically means I have two lead funnels I'm looking after. I'm looking after Microscan's lead funnel, but I'm also looking after that lead funnel for global distribution network. Oh, one last thing.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I was just going to add, Microscan is actually a Spectris company, so we are one of these Spectris companies. Spectris is based out of the UK. They're a precision instrumentation and controls company. They own about 15 different technology companies, of which Microscan is part.
Now, this is going to be really interesting because I don't think we've had anybody on the show that went to market 100% through channel. So I definitely want to come back and find out a little bit more about that. But before we get into that, Laura, let's first take a look at your journey to revenue marketing, because I tell you what's so interesting. I don't often run across somebody who has worked across three different marketing automation systems, but tell us a little bit about your journey to revenue marketing.
It's funny. The first time I heard revenue marketer was just a few months ago, and I immediately recognized myself from prior to the revenue marketing definition tools of CRM and marketing automation and responsible for revenue. Because honestly, for the past 12 years, I've been accountable for the sales lead funnel in the sense of sales lead generation being given to me as a top priority. It's great to have, you know, pretty photos and nice ad campaigns, but if the results weren't there in sales leads, I've been more judged consistently on end result of sales leads than sort of the marketing arts and crafts people think of.
Now, that's interesting because you've been doing that and had that kind of accountability for 12 years. Why do you think that was? I mean, you're classically a marketer, correct?
You know, yes, I think it's, yes, I am classically a marketer. So my path up through marketing, I was an events manager, I've done copywriting, I've done design creative, so I did have sort of the traditional marketing path. But I think it may be the dynamics of Microscan and how it – so I've been at Microscan for the past 12 years. So let me put that into play. I reported to the president directly for almost 10 of those years, and he's very revenue-oriented. It's that, you know, Laura, how are you going to impact revenue question.
So I love it. Okay.
Even though my toolkit or marketing – campaigns and brochures and websites, but it had always been at the end of the day, you have a lead funnel you need to fill. And before CRM, before marketing automation, the general rule of thumb was every year at minimum, my sales lead quota raised 20%. I had to at minimum grow sales leads 20% year on year, every single year.
You actually had a quota?
Yeah, well, it was my, yes. So it was my goal, and it's, you know, something I get judged on annually in my performance reviews, and the sales leads are very visible out to the company. We would report out on dashboards how many leads we have for the month and how many leads to plan.
So, Laura, did you have variable comp tied to that sales quota? That sales lead quota?
Wish. No, it's just pride of a job well done.
Okay. So you've been able to work with the company and get 20% year-over-year growth on from baseline on the number of sales leads, and I would imagine there's a certain amount of quality associated with those leads, as well as running both sales and marketing functions, and just having that kind of background, I also think, kind of helps you with your perception of the role of marketing. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I would also like to say, though, that the transition point, so that 20% year-on-year on leads, was really before we had the ability to track other things beyond lead volume. So since the implementation of we use Salesforce for our CRM and we use marketing automation platforms, since those implementations, the sales lead volume is way over. It definitely exceeds the 20% mark because you have the ability to expand your definition of a lead, to nurture leads to a certain point. So 20% was that's old school.
Okay.
For me.
So how long have you guys been using marketing automation as part of your mix?
Just about 3 years.
Okay.
Three and a half years. We started in 2007.
Okay. And what system do you guys use today?
Today we're at the tail end of our contract with Eloqua. I'm a big, huge fan of Eloqua, and we're also looking at other platforms that help bring in more of the sales package to it.
Okay. All right. Excellent. And so if 20% was kind of like a baseline, are there any other metrics that you guys kind of track and are important for you?
Yeah, well, actually, what's important, we have a few KPIs, and a lot of them are related to web metrics, but what I really look at, what's really important to me personally, is looking at in Salesforce.com and seeing the trail of opportunities by leads and source. And on the website, looking at conversion metrics from visitors to actual forms. So the actual conversions are what I pay the most attention to.
Okay. And how long have you been tracking?
The numbers are great.
Okay. And how long have you guys been tracking those KPIs?
In a really formalized, prioritized dashboard way, just this year since 2010.
Okay.
Before that, it was just sort of Excel spreadsheets that we would send around.
And is your dashboard in Salesforce?
Not all of it. So pieces of it come from Salesforce.
Because
we bring in, we have five areas. So I track brand awareness. I track web visits. We track activity on our website. And then we track the interest, which is the marketing automation platform and how leads go through the funnel.
Okay. And so this dashboard that kind of reports on and tracks those five key areas, is that your dashboard or is that a dashboard that goes up to the executive committee?
Both. So
okay.
It's produced by the marketing group. It's a dashboard for my group. It's just sort of a general viewpoint of how the trends are going, and it is provided to the executive staff of the company every month. And sometimes we also forward it out to the sales team, but not on a every month basis to the broad sales team.
And how do you think your senior management responds to that dashboard?
Well, today I think it's just an expected deliverable. When we first came
Excellent.
Out with it, they thought it was pretty cool.
Okay. But that's perfect. Just like sales delivers a pipeline, you're also delivering key metrics that talk about the health of the company.
Absolutely.
Okay.
One thing that might be interesting to you, Debbie, is I was listening to some of your other revenue marketing radio, and Aon, company Aon. A turning point for me in marketing automation and when I was evaluating how I discovered it and stumbled upon it, I was at a Salesforce Dreamforce conference, and I attended a presentation that overviewed how Aon was using Eloqua. It opened my eyes. I was like, wow. So all of these separate programs that we had separate email marketing, separate webcast, separate, you know, web metrics. When I looked at what Aon was doing, I was like, I want to do that. How do I do that? I want to do that.
That is a great story, and just confirms my belief that it's a very, very small world that we live in. I'll have to tell Angela Sanders that. That is so very, very cool. So that began opening your eyes, but I also know that you mentioned that you guys brought in CRM, Salesforce.com, and then brought in marketing automation. Is that right?
Yes.
Well, tell us a little bit about that journey and what that was like.
Okay, that journey was a direct result of, it was about 4.5 years ago, my role transitioned. So I have always been responsible for the marketing function, but in 2006, I became also responsible for two functions that had formerly been in sales, the channel distribution program and the sales lead development program. Now, overnight, when you suddenly look at marketing kind of from an arts and crafts and lead generation perspective, and overnight, now I have the next piece of the funnel. I have the lead development, and I have to keep these partners happy and fed, and I've got two funnels, not one funnel. Completely changed my perspective. And that's when I started just looking at some simple processes. And at that time, our process for lead management, our process for communicating with our global field operations and sales and our global distributors was not as effective as it could have been. And so I was doing some research, and I contacted some of my sister Spectris companies and marketing people to find out how they solved this problem. And Salesforce.com just kept coming up. So Salesforce.com started at MicroScan. Not as this global implementation package. I started really small with just a few licenses to help manage the lead funnel, and we were manually pulling reports and emailing them out to the field. So we started small with Salesforce. It wasn't a corporate decision at first. It was just a lead management marketing decision, and that's since blossomed. Now the full company is on Salesforce and seeing the benefits, and once all the field sales managers got into Salesforce, once that transition was made, then I looked for the next level of improvement, which was how do I bring and connect marketing activity into Salesforce to be visible and active.
Now, one of the things that I find interesting was that you were managing two lead funnels.
Yeah.
So tell me specifically what these lead funnels were.
Yeah, and I don't know if I would say more like driving or influencing those two lead funnels. So Microscan, the lead funnel that I would be judged on, that I'd mentioned, that 20% year-on-year growth, is the total volume of leads generated by Microscan for our technologies, products, and solutions. Those
but
leads
these
can get
leads
passed off to
passed to distributors, right?
Correct.
Okay.
But secondarily, if you're going to market through a distribution channel, you're really only going to be effective if your distribution channel has mindshare about your products, if they know your products, if they're happy doing business with you, if
gotcha.
It's easy to do business with you.
Gotcha.
And sales people and distributors are very coin operated. You know, you
mm-hmm.
give them money and you give them a lead, and a lead is practically money, then they're happy and you get more of their mindshare.
Yes.
So we had separate cooperative marketing programs that I would run with our distributors that would help them and encourage them to create their own marketing campaigns to generate their own leads for Microscan on top of what we provide to them.
That is so smart. So clearly you were running or driving a lead funnel so you could get leads and pass them to the distributors. And then your second funnel was around the mind share and then providing marketing tools to your channel so they could more effectively market Microscan solutions.
Correct, because they are the local voice and they know the local stuff. We do some like global outreach that's generic, but usually people need some type of automation solution. They want to deal with the local company that they can get on the phone and the guy that can come visit them and train them. So we needed the global local marketing reach. And we did something really interesting on one of our product launches last year that our distributors loved, and we did it through our marketing automation system. We created a kind of, we called it just like a co-op marketing online campaign, but how you can have context-sensitive, how you can easily have it in marketing automation systems, have context-sensitive landing pages. We created a promotion that was just basically a web button, a banner ad that we asked our distributors to, mirrored our corporate branding that we were doing for a promotion campaign. We said, hey, can you guys put this on your website? And it was about the product, and it was a custom contest. And so we were giving away iPods. Whatever iPod was popular last year, I can't remember. We were giving them away.
Okay. All right.
So basically, it was a hosted contest for our partners. So all they had to do was put this out there and then send out emails and promote this contest as much as they could. But we managed all the separate contest pages through our marketing automation system. So they got to see reports of every single person who entered their own unique contest.
That is so cool.
And they loved it. It's like, oh, I just put a banner button ad. I tell people about it, and you're going to give me reports of who's in the contest. And we managed, so it seemed like it was their own branded contest, their own branded logo. But we did this simultaneously with about 30 key partners over
so
a period of 3 months.
So that is just, what a great idea.
Well, thank
That's
you.
Fantastic. And I'm sure that they loved the campaign and got a great benefit from it.
Sure, and they didn't have to buy the iPods.
I know, absolutely. And so were you able to quantify a value from, I mean, did they close business? I'm assuming that they did.
Yes, we did have quite a few demo opportunities, and I believe we did close business on it. I promoted it more when I was speaking to partners. I would approach it from the angle of, hey, we're doing the marketing for you, and look at all of these leads and look at these contacts.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because that's always the problem with the channel, mind share, and the more you can own their marketing, the more you're going to own their mind share. I think that's awesome. Laura, let me ask you this question, because this is always a problem when you've got a distributor network. When you pass those leads over to the distributors, did you have any visibility to what happened to them from there?
Wow, you just nailed a hot spot on the head. We've been varying levels of visibility. So it's a challenge because we don't put all of our 300 distributors on Salesforce accounts. So we do have visibility, but it's in the form of our Microscan sales managers often. We prompt to follow up and say, hey, what happened
yep.
to this lead? How is this project going?
Okay.
The complete cycle that we have to connect doesn't always come through, if that makes sense.
Okay.
I can view, maybe not to the end sale perspective, but I can view those opportunities as they progress through the funnel with through our field sales managers. So all the way through to what stage of that opportunity and what's that dollar amount, we can view that piece of it. But I believe there's stuff that's just not getting updated.
Yeah. That's very cool. And do some of your distributors have Salesforce that you guys are connected to?
Yes. Some of them do. Some of the larger ones do.
That's got to be very beneficial to them and you.
Oh, yes. You know, Salesforce, the whole CRM marketing automation, what it gives to companies is just really amazing. I am just such a fan of everyone's under pressure to do more with less and reduce costs. And some people look at the cost of a CRM or marketing automation and say, look how expensive that is. But the actual efficiencies of scale and the benefits you get out of it, it's not even a doubt in my mind. Any company should, if they're not doing it today, they should be looking at it.
I mean, you are so right. And I often think about, when I think about the cost of CRM and marketing automation, I'm like, compared to what? You know? I mean, if you really think about the value versus the cost, and not in every situation, but in most situations, it's going to be two things. It's going to be the economies of scale that you gain, how a small marketing department can operate and put output like a big marketing department, and also how you impact revenue and the fact that you can actually track the effect that marketing is having on revenue. So I always say, and I truly think that in a lot of ways, marketing and CRM, is little underpriced, quite frankly, for the value. I think especially marketing automation, because it is such a proactive, direct revenue contributor. So that's my diatribe on the value anyway. So
I gotta tell you, you know what I called it when I was first looking at Eloquent, trying to explain it to, like, well, here's what it is, and I, you know, think about it as a marketing robot. You know, think about it as a headcount, like this automated, like it. Think about it that way.
You know what, Laura, I've never heard the marketing robot, but you know what analogy I have used with people? I've said, think about the best salesperson you have sitting on your website and looking at all the behaviors and deciding how to respond to what kind of behavior.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly what it's like. If you think about how we used to always interact with people face-to-face and on the phone, those are days before the internet, salespeople could read that body language. Well, to me, marketing automation is like having your number one sales rep looking at all the interactions that are happening in the digital world and directing that traffic and bringing that prospect on into the funnel. So I just like you, I just see it as being something extraordinarily powerful for many organizations. Now, I got to tell you, Laura, when we were talking about your interview, and I said, okay, what do you want to talk about? And the way, just let everybody know, the way I set these interviews up, people can talk about anything. It's just whatever they're passionate about. And then Laura came back and told me, well, I want to talk about pragmatic revenue marketing. I thought, oh, that is a phenomenal thought. So why don't you tell us your thoughts on that and how it applies to today's revenue marketing?
Sure. So pragmatic marketing is, they offer certification courses, and what it really is you can check it up online. It's a market-driven model for managing and marketing technology products, largely B2B products. And I believe, I'm not certain, I believe it began as more of a product management model
that has been expanded into
marketing. And some of the basis of pragmatic marketing is, hey, it's not about your product. Even if you think you have the greatest product today, someone's going to have the greatest product, you know, 2 months from now. So the basis is it's not about your product. What you need to think about is you need to think about the buyers, who is buying this, think about their needs, and look at their behaviors on their path to buying. So, for example, taking something and dividing to three stages. There's an early, mid, and a late stage in a buying process. Maybe the middle stage is where someone's actually doing that head-to-head product demo, and they're looking at product specs, and they're, you know, but before that, someone was assigned to probably research a problem or a solution, such as we have a problem with quality on our floor, and we need to track better quality. Can you look at barcode or vision? So someone was assigned to research and look at solutions on the front end on the early stage. And then on the tail end, you have the people who, you know, have that veto power on the sale. You've got more of the financial buyers, the purchasing department. And pragmatic marketing says, beware of that entire path. Look at everything from, and try to align your messaging and try to align your content marketing materials to those targets. It's, you know, give the right piece of information at the right time. It is not about batch and blast marketing to everyone in your database the same message. It's about being realistic about who needs what information and disseminating that information to that person. And marketing automation platforms, they actually is actually brought up in it. In one of the pragmatic marketing pieces of it, they basically talk about, it's a small piece of it, but they say, hey, this, you know, marketing automation platforms are the ones that allow companies to do this in an automated way. You know, don't be scared by all the different ways you need to slice and dice people and behaviors, because marketing automation platforms are coming on board that make this part easier. And I've been at a few seminars for online marketing and also this pragmatic marketing, and people will say, oh, how many of you in the room use marketing automation? And usually I'm one of maybe 10% in the room. It always surprises me.
You know, this is so interesting because I've also run product marketing and development as well, and pragmatic is a great approach. And over the, I could probably say the last 18 months, and talking to some marketers, I've actually run into marketers who use that ability to quickly read levels of interest to help them test and come to market with great product ideas. And I'll give you a great example of how this happened. So in my last company, before I came to the Pedowitz Group, we were using marketing automation, and my salespeople kept saying, you know, we got to do this other kind of solution. I'm like, well, this is way outside the line, and I'm not sure. So we were doing a nurturing campaign around thought leadership, and we did one around at-home agents and just how difficult it was to hire call center agents. And the response to the campaign was like off the charts, let me tell you.
Yeah.
So we knew we had hit a hot button here, and so eventually we wound up creating a fifth solution to our core component set around a tool that helps you assess and hire call center agents. And again, we did it through using our marketing automation system and just testing the level of interest and finding out exactly what areas people were interested in when it came to a product. And I've actually run into a couple of other companies who had been using marketing automation, you know, for more than a year, they've been using for a few years, who kind of do the same thing. So again, if you think you have a product idea, you can test the efficacy of the idea, you can test how the market responds to the idea, and then even as you go into product development, you can test it using marketing automation. So I could see why the pragmatic group had wanted to include and had kind of talked about, you know, using marketing automation as a way to, you know, does this hit a buyer hot button, and take a look at their online behavior in response to that.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the challenges, though, that a challenge I have experienced, how's that, is it's a different mindset to try to, in reality, deploy these, because the deliverables and what's needed, the marketing automation is such a cool tool. You want to do everything. You just want to try it all. And it really, really becomes a content game. You really need to know your content and know your audience, and it's a different type of mindset for the for marketing automation. You know, outside of the tool set, you really need to have sort of a little bit of psychology and strategy, and you have to think in layers, almost like your Photoshop has layers you turn on and off. You need to have campaigns that have layers that turn on and off based on their behavior. Did they open the email? Did they not? Did they respond? So one of the challenges that I continue to try to improve on, my Kaizen, you know, 1% at a time, is getting relevant content, getting better content, and being smarter with how we set up workflows and campaigns and programs.
So what are some of the, because I know that you feel and I feel that, you know, content's king, and this is kind of like the fuel that goes in the engine, and how you work with content and how you treat content's very important. So, Laura, give us some examples of some of the ways that you guys have changed your content marketing strategy and just kind of how you approach the whole question of content.
Well, the question of content, this will always continue to be a continuous improvement hot button for me. We start small. So we'll take things like a white paper campaign. We'll have three or four white papers that are very specific to an audience or a problem, and we'll put a banner or a button out on a very specific niche website that people go to, and they can either download that white paper. We don't ask for everything out of the gate. We don't want their whole life because we're not going to turn them over to sales yet. We just want to maybe get their email address to download that so then we can connect with them later on maybe a related white paper or a related webcast. That's how we started. We do a lot on just one piece of content, perhaps a very targeted white paper. We tried generic things. I tried doing one with our catalog. Hey, look at us. Look at our products. And people don't want that. Well, some people do, but the highest return was the more targeted we get, the better results I see.
So is your notion in this example, this white paper, where you start small, maybe put a banner or a button on the niche site, and you get people to download it, is it just so that you can build your opt-in list to quality leads so that you can nurture them until you see signs from their behavior that they're ready for a substantive sales conversation?
Kind of. I mean, so we do try to build in an opt-in list, but depending on what that white paper might be, if it's for a specific, if it's very targeted to an exact, hey, someone's reading about that problem, wow, we have that answer. There are some that will escalate over into sales quicker.
Okay.
So when we go through, so I think on average for this year, I was looking at the numbers recently for the year, and I was looking at what went into, we've been using Eloqua this year, what has gone into Eloqua versus what shows up in Salesforce and is passing through. We retain about 60% of our incoming into Eloqua. We pass through approximately 40% directly to sales.
So what have you found out? Because people always ask me this question. What kind of content's best, right? So how do you answer that question?
I wish I knew. I'm experimenting with that one every day, every week.
Do you have any high value? Do you have any high value content pieces that's an automatic? Ooh, we had to get that over to sales, or is it always a combination of the content piece plus something else?
No, we do have a couple that are high value that go straight over into sales because we will know, hey, if someone's reading about that specific topic, we have the answer to that problem.
Okay.
So there are some. Not everything isn't considered high value to go to sales because, honestly, one of the challenges I used to have for a period of time in my team, sales lead development, and over the past year and a half, that actually changed and went back over into the sales realm and said, oh, sales guys will qualify and develop their own leads. Well, what happened was these sales guys that had a lead developer beforehand, and now that lead developer is gone, when they saw the volume of incoming on that filter, it's been a little overwhelming. So that's partly why this year we really do retain 60%. We don't give everything over to sales because they just don't have the answer on the lead development side.
Okay, so there used to be an interim step to further qualify the leads, and then that step went away, so now you're having to apply more rigorous filters before you pass something over to sales.
Exactly, because I used to have that interim step was the human touch.
Yeah.
And, you know, just challenges. Lots of companies have had challenges in this time, too. We sell to manufacturing, and manufacturers were hit hard. So we needed to, in marketing, find ways to be smarter with our automated reach and nurture and not rely as much on the human touch.
And that is something that we've seen across a lot of companies. I would say in the last 18 months, we're seeing more and more marketing organizations are adding that additional touch. So even with CRM and marketing automation, even with lead scoring, we're finding, I would probably say 25% of the people that we've had on the radio show this year have marketing has some kind of inside telequalifying person. It's a human touch who really are taking a look at the BANT questions, budget authority, need, and time, and assessing whether or not they should push that lead over to sales, whether they should put them into some kind of nurture campaign. So that does seem to be, you know, the way it's going. So let me ask you this, Laura. So since that role went away for you guys, how much more rigorously are you guys applying lead scoring to a lead before it passes over to sales?
We tightened it up a little bit. I want to say maybe 20% or something. But what we really did, the lead scoring, we targeted more towards specific, we changed the value of content pieces. So we tightened up what was an automatic pass-through on high-value content. When we had it initially, we're setting things up, I had a very wide net because we had that human touch development piece. So we did tighten up, and it was largely just on identifying specific content pieces that, okay, that's not an automatic pass-through, now that's a nurture.
Okay, so in addition to white papers, what other kinds of content do you guys use in the digital world?
Invitations to webcasts, webinars. I still mix in traditional marketing. We still do events and trainings. I do believe that as things become more digital and people are having these virtual sort of relationships with companies by understanding their products and understanding, you know, reading white papers and watching webcasts, I believe that some of the more physical, tangible things are coming back to becoming important. Like, people want to know there's a real company behind that web page. So they like to have that physical product catalog, or see you at a trade show, or see a picture that they know that you were at a trade show, that you're real people.
So, okay, Superwoman, you guys are doing everything within that
a
marketing
bit of
department. Webcast, events, training, campaigns. So what do you have, like 8 or 10 people on your team?
Oh, I wish. Today we have a slimmed down team from what we've had in the past. We're small but powerful. So out of our corporate, because we're a global company, but marketing is centralized here right outside of Seattle, Washington, in the U.S., we have three core roles. One is the online marketer, who is a technologist position. They own all the web, everything on the website, our email marketing, our marketing automation. The counterpart to that is our marketing communications person. That really is what people think of as traditional marketing, the, you know, materials creation, logos, branding, literature, things of that nature. Then we have a product marketer, and the product marketer is a fairly new role that I brought in, and the product marketer is really to come in and help on the pragmatic marketing concept, help define a bit more of our buyers and messaging and campaign content outline, so driving some of the content to the tools we have in marketing communications and the tools that we have in online marketing.
Is everyone in the U.S.?
Those roles I described, we are all here in the U.S. This year I was also able to add recently a person in China, and we're currently looking to add another person in Europe. So it's been interesting because I've been having conversations about these concepts of content marketing and the concepts of online marketing and bringing people in to do these, to rubber stamp some of the things we're doing in the U.S., in Asia, and in Europe. And I think the U.S. is a little more progressive right now.
So what is your team member doing in China?
Oh, she does a little bit of everything. She's great. So she coordinates trade shows. She coordinates distributor partner events. She updates our web pages, sends out our press releases. So a lot of things, we probably originate about 75% content here that gets kind of repackaged and sent over there, and then about 25% of the stuff she's out getting new content, documenting customer applications, partner co-op marketing, like I'd mentioned before, we have partners, so helping them with their needs.
Now, Laura, are you guys doing everything in English, or are you in multiple languages?
Oh, multiple languages for sure. So we support 9 languages standard, including English. And, you have to. It could be a ticket to the dance.
So how do you handle that from a campaign perspective?
Well, that's a great question. We can tell, on the Asian languages, you know, we can absolutely tell who needs to have, because Salesforce can accommodate all of the kanji characters. So we do have Chinese data in Salesforce and English data in Salesforce. Anyone who's come through our website and given us information on our English website, we feel comfortable sending them materials in English, even if their email address is .fr or .de. We do more English language email outreach than foreign language, and we try to target once a quarter something special in the different languages unique to just that geographical and language group.
That is very, very cool. So it sounds like when you think about the notion of revenue marketing, you do have some differentiation in that you've got three primary roles, MarCom, online marketing, product marketer, and also clearly you're the revenue marketing strategist on the team. But it also sounds as though there's some, you know, some crossover between people's roles as well, which probably I would think creates more value for you.
I would hope so.
Okay. So let's talk about, I know one of the things that you and I have talked about in the past is how marketing automation requires new thinking. And before I kind of get specifically into that topic, I want to talk about another mindset shift. So you've introduced the concept of pragmatic marketing. And, you know, that whole notion of pragmatic marketing is really it's product development, product marketing. So if you had a company that was filled with product marketers, what do you think their transition would be like to revenue marketing? How do you think you could affect that?
The product marketers I meet seem to be very much idea people. And I think that someone who's exposed to the tools and can see the potential of, say, what an Eloqua, a Marketo, those marketing automation platforms, I think that the path would be pretty clear and quick to adoption. I think they would see it as an easier way to get their message out and get things done.
Go ahead, Laura.
Oh, go ahead. No, I said they really seem to have almost the frustration point can almost be, I've met all these things I want to do. I have all these great ideas to hand off, but how many people do you have to make them real? And marketing automation helps make those campaigns real faster.
I love that. And we actually just went through a similar experience. We were working with a company, and they had actually brought in a team from around the globe, and these were all product marketers. And I think the first day they were kind of struggling with, what is this demand generation, revenue marketing? Well, we are revenue marketers. We create products, and those products drive revenue. And it wasn't until we showed them what a marketing automation system could do, and when we did that, they got it. They did exactly what you just said, Laura. They were able to think, oh, I could do this, and I could do this, and I could do this. And so it was a really interesting exercise for them. So, you know, going from product marketing to revenue marketing is one thing. But I know that, you know, you talk a lot about how marketing automation requires new thinking. And I have to tell you, going into an organization and saying, you have to think in a new way, you know, can be real challenging. So tell us what your thoughts are around that.
Well, for me, it was a gradual experience. So I fell in love with the possibility and the potential of the software and what it could do in marketing automation and uniting all these things. I fell in love with that before I realized the realities of new thinking being changed. So my thinking adjusted over time as we rolled things out. The new thinking is really, there's so much data, and there's explicit data on someone's, you know, job title, company, or geographic location, or there's implicit data, their behavior online, what did they download, how many times have they visited. To connect those data points and bring them back to make a judgment call about, are they a lead, are they not a lead, what type of content should we feed them next, it's really a different thinking process. You need to think in layers, and you need to kind of combine psychology with demographics and arts and crafts.
Well, first of all, I love the way you talk about arts and crafts and marketing, and I think there's probably a whole lot of truth to that. But the other thing that you said that I really like a lot is how you have to think in layers, and also how your thinking changes over time. And what I like to tell marketers is that when you begin this revenue marketing journey, what you don't know is stunning. But the pace at which you will learn what you don't know is equally stunning. So I remember when I bought my first marketing automation system, I thought I was going to be all hot, ready to go, you know. And then I started doing stuff, and I'm like, where am I, you know? But I also saw that on a quarterly basis, we had a Kaizen approach, definitely a Kaizen approach. And we would just review, and at the end of every quarter, I knew so much more than I did at the beginning of that quarter, whether it was what behavior really means when I'm interacting with prospects in the digital world, or what it really means if somebody downloads a white paper, or what it really means to have a score of 87, or what it really means to be, you know, to do dynamic content. So, again, what I knew changed over time, but it changed very rapidly. Didn't you find that as well?
Yes, absolutely. And it's like learning to swim by being pushed into the pool, I guess. You know, you just figure it out. But the benefits, you see the benefits so quickly when things work well. It's experimental. You're like, oh, that didn't work. Let's avoid that. This worked. Great. We'll do more of that. And you just kind of keep tweaking your own A-B testing. Oh, that worked better. Let's do more of that. That worked better. Let's do more of that.
That's exactly right. So clearly you got it from an early stage. What about the rest of your marketing team? Were they on board as fast as you were, Laura?
Oh, I think being the person that gets judged by the results end of it, I'm a little more enthusiastic. I mean, they're all on board with it, and they think it's cool, but I'm a bit more of the cheerleader on this, I think, than the team. Because the team pulls together and sees the, you know, one person's working on the creative and the messaging, and another person's pushing the magic buttons on the marketing automation system, and another person is looking at, you know, who's the right audience. People still have a tendency when you're in the detail mode, you know your part helps someone else's part, but people are still pretty focused on their piece. Like the designer wants to make the best design, and the web technologist wants the smartest campaign path.
And you know that's absolutely true. Again, when you've got people who have different roles and they're only doing a piece of it. But I was talking to a VP of marketing probably about a year and a half ago, and she was specifically hired to come in and run a demand generation or a revenue marketing practice for this company. And they spent a long time looking for someone with that particular skill set. And when she came in and we were talking, I said, well, what was your biggest challenge? And I thought she was going to say, you know, aligning with marketing or picking the right marketing automation system. She says, no, it was my team. She said, you know, they didn't get it. They were so traditional in marketing, but like, we can't make an impact on revenue. You know, what are you talking about? So that was a big, big challenge for her coming in. She actually had to finally, you know, wind up doing some readjusting, because this does require a brand new skill set. It's just not a traditional skill set. I think for some people it gets in the way, but for some people it just becomes a great foundation, and it sounds like for you it was a phenomenal foundation.
Yeah, I love it.
So you've been doing this for 4 years. So has it been a smooth path to success?
No. I mean, there have been high points and low points, of course, and bumps in the road. It's been overall, you know, a great path. I would say that there was a point where things, you know, if I was going to say something derailed or there's some one lesson learned, was when things beyond your control occur, such as the moment when we had some changes in our senior staff of our organization, and they came in and they adjusted bodies around marketing and sales. And from a smaller company that I had, a small, medium-sized company that I have been involved with, they brought in management from more Fortune 500 companies that came in and was more set on, well, this is what marketing does, this is what sales does. And so sort of the hybrid marketing sales role that I had said, no, those things just need to go back into sales. And that was when the sales lead development process moved back into sales outside of marketing, when all of the channel lead funnel moved back into sales and outside of marketing. And what that effectively did was it changed the definition of a sales-ready lead. Because sales-ready lead up until that point had been a sales-ready lead agreed upon, and it was nurtured and qualified. And sales-ready lead then became, about a year and a half ago, anything marketing throws over the fence. And so I had to go back to throwing it over the fence mode. But that was what we had talked about a little earlier, that I said we had to tighten up and try to do things through email and reevaluate what was high-value content and find other ways to work around it. But when things beyond your control like that happen, it can be a challenge. That's probably my largest challenge.
And they will happen. And quite frankly, the situation that you just described, where you have someone in sales who thinks that the sales organization should do everything top to bottom and marketing should be in a completely different world, I think many organizations are still there. And I think it's based on lack of information and really lack of knowledge. But if you go out and you take a look at the research done by companies like Jim Dickey at CSO Insights, and I think for the fourth or fifth year in a row, first of all, Jim's report on sales, I think it's in its 14th or 15th year. It's the definitive report on what's going on in selling. And for the fourth or fifth year in a row, they've got VPs of sales who are saying, marketing, you need to take over the top of the funnel, and you need to take the time to nurture and get these leads ready for us. So I think that is a big shift in sales, is that they're seeing, if you think about a salesperson, typically the most highly paid, very valuable resources in a company, and day in and day out, when a manager is talking to a sales rep about where they are on quota, they spend very little time talking about how many hours did you cold call, how's your prospecting going. 99% of their conversation is going to be around opportunities already in the pipeline and where they are against closing that. Further, salespeople truly are not classically trained to work the top of a funnel. So, again, there is this huge trend, around, marketing, using marketing automation systems, creating these digital relationships, and nurturing those leads at the very top of the funnel until they're sales ready, and then passing those over to sales. So I think that is definitely the new way of thinking. And you're right, Laura, when you have a sales and marketing organization that doesn't, they just don't see eye to eye on that, it kind of sets up challenges for you, and I can see that. But, and it's true in every organization, no matter where you are as a marketer, things happen within the organization politically or however they're based, that can create challenges for your program. But it sounds like, again, you've been very, very smart about how you responded to that move and that you're still creating great value for the sales organization.
Why, thanks. I tried to respond as smartly as I could, and actually we're still we're looking at going back to what can we do, because the lesson learned is kind of what you had said. The salespeople, they want to focus on things that are further down the funnel, so it hasn't necessarily been the most successful to ask salespeople to be more on the front end of the lead nurturing. So we are looking at some other options to improve that aspect. One thing that I see is just a different mentality between marketing and sales that I can explain. Just, I was recently at a trade show just a couple weeks ago, and I saw a person standing in the aisle looking at one of our displays, and it was a young guy, and I looked at his badge, and it said he was an associate production engineer level 1, and he was with a major target company that I know we're trying to pursue. So I look at him and I say, hey, here's a guy fresh out of college, first job at one of our target companies, just checking out what we have. So I bring him into the booth, and I start talking to him about his job and what they do and explaining just sort of the benefits of our products. At some point, our sales manager looks over and probably saw the company name on his badge, came over, joined the conversation, and absolutely immediately jumps in and starts talking about, well, have you seen this new product? Do you put this on your line? I know you guys, and just started elevating it as if the person was ready to demo two products side by side. I hadn't even taken the conversation there yet. I wasn't talking about specific products and why we're better. I was just still talking about what problems he was experiencing and, oh, hey, we've solved this for another customer. And for me, it just really I clearly identified kind of the difference between the mentality of a marketer and a salesperson.
I could not agree more, and clearly, it's all about creating customer relationships these days. So, Laura, you've been at this for 4-plus years. Worked across multiple systems, had a lot of experiences. So what's kind of next for you as you take a look at marketing automation and contributing revenue and value into sales?
Next for me is helping more on aligning sales with the benefits of marketing automation. So we're looking at ways of improving within the Salesforce interface how sales managers can manage their own leads, and looking at adding sales playbooks, sales lead development nurturing playbooks that allow field sales managers to assign campaigns and assign leads onto these nurturing tracks. So we're looking at ways just to make the entire lead nurture process easier and better for everyone in our field sales organization.
Well, I think that's something that would be highly valuable, I think, for any company. And I really encourage you, go get a copy of Jim Dickey's latest report from CSO Insights and share that with sales. And, because a lot of times executives work based on data. Show me the data. Show me what other companies are doing. Tell me what, best-in-class companies are doing. And then I think you can just kind of take it from there. So what advice would you give to a brand new revenue marketer, Laura, somebody first kind of getting into this?
I would say just dive in and start, and don't be intimidated by, there's all these things you can do, and don't get the overanalysis paralysis and think we have to have everything perfectly done in 20 campaigns in order to go. Start with one, be successful, build out from there, or start with five and be successful, build out from there. The potential of what the stuff can do can be intimidating. So just like Nike, just do it. Jump in.
And take a Kaizen approach.
Yes.
Okay. So I have to ask you a question before we complete the interview. I'm going to put you on the spot here. But we kind of coined the phrase the revenue marketer. And so given your experience, how would you complete this phrase, Laura? You know you're a revenue marketer when?
Oh, wow, that is putting me on the spot. I don't have the creative, cute answers.
Well,
you know what that means before you've actually heard the definition.
That's so awesome. And I've heard a lot of people when they hear the phrase revenue marketer, they say, that's what I am. And they kind of get that instantly. It's just something that we've been playing around with for about the last month. And some of the more creative ones we've heard are like, you're a revenue marketer if you mark your ex-boyfriend closed, lost in Salesforce.com. Or you're a revenue marketer if when you speak to the VP of sales, he doesn't sound like he's speaking Klingon. And I have one more. Because I've been gathering these, Laura, because like you, I didn't come up with the funny stuff at first. But you also know you're a revenue marketer when you give a lead to sales and they don't toss back rotten vegetables,
Very nice. Okay, I'm going to think of a funny one, and I'm going to go to your website, and I'm going to add a funny one.
Okay. You go, and I've got a blog on it, so you can go to the blog, and you can absolutely add that. Well, Laura, thank you so much for being on the show today. We've really, really enjoyed having you. Have a great week, and all your revenue marketers out there, just keep on doing your thing. It is a wonderful space to be in. It's a wonderful career choice to have. And there's nothing like being able to put revenue and contribute revenue to the top line of your organization. So everyone have a great day.